stand.
Make sure the mics are working. Let's all please stand for the Pledge of Allegiance.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, with liberty, and justice for all.
Someday. Good.
Good evening, Commissioners.
Roll call.
I'd like to take the roll call. Thank you. Chair Hartwig?
Present.
Vice Chair Hurd?
Present.
Tanya Pitts is excused. Chair Moses Main is excused. Barbara Montgomery?
Here.
Chani Castillo?
Present.
And Adi Nagraj?
Present.
Thank you.
Okay, do we have a motion for the approval of the minutes?
I'll move to approve.
I'll second.
We have a motion. We have a second. All in favor, please say aye.
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 All those opposed? Any abstentions? Carries unanimously. Okay, moving on to old or unfinished business. Item A.
Item A. Good evening, Commissioners. Item A and B are both unfinished business or carryovers from our previous item, previous meeting where we had the public hearing. They are to approve our 2014 MTW Making Transition Work Plan. During the course of plan, we did receive one comment. It was a letter which wasn't really directed specifically at the plan, but it was that she requested we share it with the commission. It was an open public comment, so I did include it about eligibility and screening, so we've included that response as well. There were no other comments to our plan during the comment period, and we support moving to approve it and get it sending it off to HUD.
Great. I'll move to approve.
I'll second that.
It's been moved. It's been seconded. All those in favor, please say aye.
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 All those opposed? Any abstentions? Carries unanimously.
Thank you, Commissioners. And moving on to item B, resolution approving changes to the Oakland Housing Authority's public housing admissions and continued occupancy policy. This is a document that corresponds in terms of the public hearing and opening to the MTW plan. It does contain some changes that were significant enough that we've included them and other grammatical changes. And there was one comment that Commissioner Nagraj said last meeting that we looked up the CFR and the typo is in the CFR.
Look at that.
So we have
federal impact.
Because there's no requirement for us to cite the CFR period, let alone a section that contains typos, we have removed it from our policy. Having said that, we've received no other comments and we move the item for approval, or we request approval.
I'll move the item.
Okay, thank you.
Do we have a second?
I'll second.
We have a motion. We have a second. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed? Any abstentions? Carries unanimously. Are there any modifications to the agenda?
I believe in the consent calendar. Oh, I'm sorry. Did you acknowledge me?
No, you may. You may go ahead.
Apologize, Chair. There is one item concerning the youth program that we're going to be engaged in. I just wanted to have more of a discussion on that one.
Okay.
I think it's item A.
Okay.
I did have good notes.
Once we get to the consent calendar,
okay,
you can request to pull that item out.
Thank you.
And we can then discuss it. Okay? Okay, so hearing no modifications to the agenda, we will move on to new business. Item A.
Item A, new business, is a recommendation for adoption of the Oakland Housing Authority Development Policy, and we have an abbreviated PowerPoint. If you'd like to indulge me, I'll walk through. It will explain what the ad hoc committee has been doing. We'll give a minute to put that up. Do you want to try and pull it up, the PowerPoint? Yeah, we are on item A. Not the MTW old one.
This is under six.
So to summarize while she's pulling that up is that the board established an ad hoc development committee. Its members were, it was chaired by Commissioner Nagraj, and the commissioners were Hartwig and Pitts that participated. They started meeting last fall. They went over a series of documents to begin drafting the policy. The goal of the policy, which I'll tell you, is the development policy was established to provide oversight to OHA staff and its consultant in the creation of a development policy to guide staff and the board in making decisions for the agency. To begin the process, they talked to a consultant that we hired, Ann Dunn. She interviewed all of the commissioners as well as a number of staff to get different ideas for the policy. And the outcomes of those discussions, as well as some documents we had her look at, were the first draft that they looked at. They looked at the MTW agreement excerpts, OHA Green Policy Statement, current OHA deal points, City of Oakland 2011-2012 Affordable Housing NOFA excerpts, and a sample policy that was done by the District of Columbia about 12 or 13 years ago that they still use regularly. The draft development policy was released on February 26th and made available to local affordable housing developers through EPHO and was posted on the OHA website. The ad hoc committee held a public meeting on March 12, 2013 to receive public comments and input on the draft policy. Written comments could also be submitted by April 15th. We did receive a number of comments at the hearing, and we received two written comments that were included in your packet as well. One from Evolsi, which you'd read, and another one from an organization called ABC, who's spoken here in the past about project labor agreements. The policy in terms of project labor agreements, by the way, does mention that or another agreement. So it isn't limiting by any way to a project labor agreement. It's open to whatever, so I just want to make you aware of that. What the policy did was, the purpose of this policy is to outline the manner in which OHA will make decisions about the acquisition of the land and the participation in the affordable housing, rehabilitation, development, and redevelopment projects. The policy has eight baseline principles that it outlines. If you take a look, those are the threshold principles that we hold true. But we also, through the policy, developed a number of impact areas. First, we looked at overall impact, then the neighborhood impact, then the resident impact, and finally sustainability. So for overall impact, OHA seeks participation in projects that will provide a significant benefit to affected tenants and the surrounding community. So the biggest picture is the overall impact. We looked at population serves and have some language about desiring that its participation strengthen communities by focusing on projects for low and moderate income populations that are underserved within the context of the local housing market, whichever neighborhood they're in. Community benefit, they seek to participate in projects that will have a benefit beyond the boundaries of the subject property. And partnerships and leverage, OHA seeks to support creative approaches such as bringing together strong partnerships between development and service providers or a variety of leverage partners that strengthen the overall financial feasibility of the project. And then we looked at the neighborhood impact, and that was more local. So you've gone from fairly broad down to a neighborhood. And that's the access to quality education, the access to public transportation, the access to supportive services and or innovative programs. And with that, we specifically say that OHA is interested in projects that propose to innovate and sustainable, propose an innovative and sustainable approach to meeting the needs of the population served. So that could mean that maybe they need certain services, but they don't really need to be on site, but they have some other innovative way of doing that, because so many of the on-site providers don't sustain. So we want innovative solutions for that. And I also kind of thought, you know, when the ad hoc committee was talking, it became really clear how much healthier it can be for folks to go out to where they need to go to get, you know, I think that's a healthy exercise. Anyway, where was I? within the SERP. Access to amenities was another strong conversation, and that by amenities, the policy is really talking about grocery stores, sufficient fresh food options, banks, drug stores, libraries, community centers, and parks. Those kind of amenities that constitute a neighborhood. Resident safety is a concern, and having a plan for that. Access to a healthy environment and to health-related services. And healthy environment can be not only access to park and recreation, but it can be also access to grocery stores, fresh fruits and vegetables, and those sort of efforts that we talk about often at the board level. Integrated neighborhoods. We want projects that are located in neighborhoods that are economically, racially, and culturally diverse. And we, in this policy, are inserting economically into sort of the view that we look at things, not just the usual protected classes. And I think that's really a good thing. For the resident impact, So we've gone from having the big broad impact, the neighborhood impact, and now we're down to the individual resident in the policy. We want a provision on the siting and sustainability of the resident services. And again, that gets back to the services that are designed based on a needs assessment and that is redone and reevaluated, and that they actually can find innovative approaches to trying to serve the needs of residents that is sustainable and not really reliant on funding directly from the project or from this, but really a sustainable approach to that is what we're looking for. The policy doesn't try and design that. It just says we want to see something that is sustainable and looks different. Economic integration within the property. OHA seeks to have an appropriate income mix with the property itself when feasible, and taking into consideration the size of the property and its location. So we're looking at the different income areas of the city and trying to integrate them in different ways and finding a balance. Economic integration, I think, is really important. Cost containment, we're looking to ensure that the per unit cost is reasonable and justifiable in the context of its local market. So it could be more expensive to develop in some neighborhoods, that would be that local market, than others within the city. And so we're taking into account those kind of considerations in the policy. Then we get to sustainability. By sustainability, there are really three areas. One is the environmentally sustainable materials and practices, which is pretty standard. Environmentally sustainable management and operating practices, which is pretty common now. And then we're also looking at financial sustainability, that we want to assess the economic return on OHA's investment and the ability of a project to maintain the proposed level of management and services and security over time. So that's the basic draft overview of the policy. I think it was a really rewarding experience for me to participate with the ad hoc committee on this. And we're available for any questions and comments by the members of the committee.
Yes.
Just a few comments as so I really appreciated the work of Commissioner Pitts and Commissioner Hartwig and Don, as well as Eric and OHA staff on this. Our goals were, in addition to everything that Eric just said, our goals were to create a policy that would provide enough guidance and enough direction for those entities that are wanting to do additional development in the city, while not being too prescriptive and layering too many additional burdens on the already long and complicated process of securing all the financing. And so our goal was to drive towards a policy direction towards what we're really interested in. And what I'm pleased by is a result that I think really achieves that balance. And in relation to that, you know, when you're building affordable housing and you're securing financing from all these different lenders, there's some requirements that you're going to have from them. So there's certain sustainability requirements and proximity to amenities. And what we also strove for here is to bolster, is to from the perspective of a jurisdiction that may have different desires, incentives than might a federal agency or might a certain kind of developer that's not as invested in a jurisdiction. We want to make sure that there is there's kind of a pushing of the envelope. And so when we talk about, I think for me the most dramatic thing is the economic impact beyond your building and into your neighborhood and how your building actually relates to the surrounding community. That for me is something that it's very easy for outside developers to come in, build, and then go. But we really want folks to be really thinking about the economic impact and the physical and the human impact in the neighborhood. Additionally, when we talk about really internalizing thoughts and costs and ideas around security and around services, we're really wanting a higher level of innovation and are really going to reward kind of creativity in a lot of the proposals that we see. Those that just go above and beyond the what you have to do to get financing. And so I think a lot of what was written here really strives to push our development partners further in helping us think differently and creating a long-lasting impact in their neighborhoods. So it was great as someone who works for a developer to go through this process of thinking about it from a lender's perspective of what we're trying to do in a neighborhood. And And I just want to thank the commissioners and staff on what I think is a really great product.
Yeah, and I would just like to add that what I feel is really key about this is the focus on community. So we're not putting up a barrier between the community we're building and the rest of the community. We're talking about the community and we're all together. And so we're really committed to doing things that are going to enhance the entire community, because that's going to enhance the community of our residents as well. And I think this is really wonderful. So do we hear a motion or are there any more comments? Oh, good.
Commissioner. Yeah, in reading the document, I'm happy to see that it's access to public transportation. A lot of times, we don't hear a lot about AC Transit, BART, and where the places are located, where the apartments of the housing authorities are located, if it's feasible for the seniors, for the school kids, or whatever. So I am happy to know that you're going to work with public transportation and make sure that it'll be given greater consideration. Because a lot of times, that's one of my major problems on some boards, is that we need more insight into public transportation, especially with developments in the communities. We need to have a way for the residents to get around. So I thank you. I appreciate this. This is very good information. And I'm just so elated to see housing moving in this great direction. Thank you.
Commissioner Hurt.
Yeah, first, I want to thank you, Commissioner Negraj, for innovation. When you look at sequestration and what's happening with that, we're going to need to do things a little more creative, and I really like this. My question is the opposition from ABC. And when I was reading the letter, they brought up a point regarding Section 3 being diminished. I don't see how that would happen. Could you answer that? I see it being expanded.
Well, there are two schools of thought with Section 3 that go around Washington.
Okay.
Just like there are two schools of thought about almost everything right now in Washington, not more than that. But one school is definitely to try and strengthen it in some way and make it more viable and close some of the holes that are in the language which contractors can use. But the other side of it is to get rid of it altogether and it as an unfunded mandate and remove it. So there wouldn't be a Section 3 requirement. They're both out there.
Okay.
The Section 3 hiring requirement requires that you hire 30% of new hires. Mm-hmm. So what happens oftentimes in large projects is that there are no new hires because the hiring is either they don't have any new hires during the project, but sometimes if you don't go back and look at previous payroll reports prior to them getting the start to see when they hired people, they could have hired people for this project a week prior to you doing the certified payroll reports, and therefore they're not registering as a new hire. So some of those things are what one group would like to strengthen. But there's definitely another group out there. Mm-hmm. And really not necessarily all, both these are bipartisan views, that it's an unfunded mandate and it shouldn't be there, and that local housing authorities can do what they want with it, and it doesn't need to be in the federal requirements. So they are both there.
You're there, okay. All right, thank you. Answer my question.
Are there any more questions or comments? Okay, well, hearing none, do we have a motion?
I'll make a motion to accept.
I'll second the motion.
Moved and seconded. All those in favor, please say aye.
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 All those opposed? All those abstaining? Carries unanimously. We now have a development policy for OHA.
Thank you, commissioners, and congratulations. The next topic is just a discussion topic and not a action item, and I want to have Janet Rice come up and we can have a conversation about the impacts of sequestration and what sequestration is. As you know, sequestration took effect in the end of this fiscal year, federal fiscal year, and the end of our fiscal year. So there's two fiscal years we're dealing with, the federal fiscal year, which ends on September 30th, and our fiscal year that ends on June 30th. The initial challenge was this current fiscal year. With the current fiscal year, I'm very happy to report that our budget was done in a conservative enough way that I think we're going to end up okay on June 30th and not have any reserves that we really need to devote toward it. It's going to be close and nominal, but I think that's a real testament to shrewd budgeting and true decisions that the board has made in terms of creating a budget for us that doesn't overstate income and that does a realistic and conservative approach of what we know could be the scenario. But that doesn't solve the process for 2014. 2014 is currently under conversations up on the Hill. They'll probably pass a budget, we would hope, by September 30th, but as we know, they may not. The 2013 continuing resolution was extended to the end of the year. The amounts that they funded were not too terribly off what we had projected. So having said that, let's look at our two fiscal years, the before and after sequestration for the current fiscal year, maybe Jenna, and we can go from there, give you an idea where we're at. On your attachments, it would be the first one in yellow is the before sequestration, and then when you go to the blue shading, it's the cut in the money that after sequestration. And if you'll notice, do you want to go over it or should I, Jenna?
No, go ahead and start. I'll just add.
In terms of subsidy earned, the first line that's yellowed, 6.3 and 186 million. And if you turn it over, I can't really read my copy. It's
5.985.
184. Even though I can't read it.
5985.
Yeah. I just know the number, sadly. So you can see the impact of the cuts. Now, the cuts of sequestration weren't as large in this fiscal year as they will be in the next because sequestration took effect, what point in March? March, I can't remember the exact date. So it's really the last 3 months of our fiscal year that we're reporting, which is why we're doing pretty well because our prorated amount in the continuing resolution that Congress passed through the end of the fiscal year, we're very close to what we projected in this year's budget, so we did okay. That's the current scenario. Now, 2014, the scenario gets a little worse. You have the regular projection for housing choice vouchers at 186, which is the bulk of our money. Going down to 184, you have 4.6. Again, it's hard to read this copy. For the operating, and a total deficit in public housing at 3.11 projected for next year, and this is based on current draft numbers, and 4.3 in the blue. So if you follow that, what I just said, I'm sure you're going to have questions on how this works. Keep in mind we're looking at a HUD sources and uses table that we submit with our plan. We have adjusted these numbers, the blue numbers, for the plan that we passed earlier, so we are incorporating sequestration into our proposed sources and uses that we're sending to HUD to try and take a look at that. We have got our draft budget for 2014 internally nearly completed. So we've had that kind of on the burner, and we haven't really pushed getting the ad hoc committee going and doing that because of this reason. So that since really last week and the numbers on the packet didn't even become final until we sent it to you Thursday morning, we put them in, and we did some more work Friday and today around where the budget is and what the projections are for next year. So we're looking and relooking at the budget requests to see, one, if we can trim some of them, and to look forward. And looking forward means looking at our HAP obligations, because the majority of our money is money we don't have authority or discretion on. If the HAP is issued and we're making HAP payments. So it's just sort of the pass-through money. And how we're going to take a program that's currently at this level and to take it down to 5%, and how we have what I'd like to call a soft landing, so we're not hurting any existing families, is the cash flow management that has to go on in the next probably 12 to 18 months. To factor in to the scenario will be the number of project-based Section 8 awards that we currently have out there that we've extended that will come online in 2014. And there may be some renewals that we can consider during 2014 that could pull that back and change the date. But we need to look at our expenditure in terms of, even if we freeze all tenant vouchers right now, we still have a number of people out searching, including veterans. We pulled all the veterans from our 2011 list are currently out searching. That's about how many? 380, I think.
Mm-hmm.
We came up with about 380 folks out looking for vouchers. So right now we've got a commitment of 380 people who are out looking. And then coming online are all the project-based Section 8 vouchers. And do you want to talk a little bit about the Section 8 vouchers in the next year and your projections?
Right. So in the next year, we kind of went through our commitments that we made over these past couple of years and took a look at what was out there. And then, you know, although the total numbers right now ended up being right around 400 project-based commitments between now and June of 2014, we then looked at individual projects in terms of what is really going to come online based on feedback from our partners. And so we do think that there will be some adjustments there, because we already know that some of our partners have had to restructure their funding and or are delaying because their projects are unable to get into the ground. But we know the projects that are on schedule that are going to come online in 2014 is Lakeside and, of course, our Lion Creek Crossing 5. And those two projects alone make up about 220 vouchers. So what we've done in the 2014 budget is we've built in an allowance to accommodate both our lease up in OPI, our external project-based voucher commitments, and to the tune of about $10.6 million. And so that's that would equate to approximately 7% over our baseline for our vouchers if everything was to come online. And so we think that that is a reasonable approach at this point, because we don't want to start pulling things back as of yet. But you know, we'll be monitoring it very, very carefully. I would say that for I wanted to just step back and talk a little bit about 13. We left the housing choice voucher prospective overlease of 4% in the budget. So currently, right now, if you look at your 2013 projection, it's showing about $162 million. And that number is based on the fact that we had anticipated being 4% overlease. Is finding it?
No.
Okay.
What page is this on?
So this is, if you look at the 2013, the yellow copy at the top says 2013, you'll see housing assistance payments halfway down the page. Under the Housing Choice Voucher column, it says $162 million. That includes 4% of overleasing. And currently, right now, we're right around 100%. So I don't think between now and June 30th we're going to get there.
I see.
So,
so we've picked up 4%. That serves as a 4% gross contingency.
That's right. That's a cush. Exactly. Exactly. So with that, although, you know, we definitely calculated our deficit to reflect that 4% overleasing, we know that we're not going to get there, because it's just a variety of circumstances have prevented us from being 4% over 100% baseline. So I think, as Eric had mentioned, 2013 will be okay, even with the reduction in funding. 2014, however, again, we have left the additional commitments in. We have assumed that the funding will stay the same from 13, that there will be no further reductions. We don't know that. So we'll be monitoring that really carefully. We just got our most recent funding letter, and our numbers are pretty solid right now. And then we've included those commitments, assuming that, you know, we will be taking a look at other opportunities to start to pull back and basically recalibrate our operations as well as our commitments for voucher utilization.
So you're assuming then that the $186 million of subsidy earned, that's going to stay the same?
For 2014, I budgeted $184 million. If you see on the in the blue.
Oh, that's in
we
the
originally
blue.
Yeah, had.
Unfortunately, what happens with the blue? The yellow is very visible.
Okay, the blue isn't.
Like,
okay.
Occluded. It's
right.
Sort of like it hits some sort of part of my eye.
Exactly. Okay. So you see the original 2014 budget, we projected $188 million in subsidy being received.
Oh, I see.
Okay. And so
cool.
Then we assumed the same level of funding after we did our 2013 sequestration cuts. And so we assume revenue earned of $184 million, $140. And then that's where, if you go down below in the blue and you see the housing assistance payments, that's at $167,138,115. And that reflects the $10.6 million that we anticipate if all of our commitments through June of 2014 came online for project-based vouchers, OPI, our transfers. We have some vouchers that are on hold. So all of those different categories, if they all came to fruition, that's where we would be in terms of the dollar value of those housing assistance payments.
And so that's kind of like a worst-case financial scenario,
absolutely,
but a best-case human helping scenario.
So in terms of the 2014 projection that you're showing, does that include the overleasing? I don't remember.
It doesn't include anything other than our actual commitments.
The actual commitments and the,
right,
and the project-based, yeah.
Right, no overleasing there.
Yeah. So what we're going to do with the budget committee when they're going to convene twice, starting the first meeting is on April 30th, is really start out with these puzzles. Look at our reserves. We have reserves to cover a number of things. Reserves are obligated in some way, but they're not going to need to be paid down the road. There's a couple of elements in the reserves that we can pull back fairly easily. Other ones that are more challenging depending on it. And we're also reevaluating all of our expenditures. But what I wanted, this is a bump in our year in terms of where we are when we get the program into the right size, which is about 100% of what we're supposed to be doing, then I think we're going to begin to be sustainable and okay again. But this next year will be a challenge, so we're going to look at how much reserves we want to commit to the 2014 budget to keep all of the project-based Section 8 vouchers awarded. We're going to make some, we're going to be pretty lean in terms of our budget requests, and I've already sent a couple of things back to the directors asking for cuts and take-backs of some capital expenditures, and we're considering a number of different options. I think we may have a better picture of this by the time we come on May 20th to you with the proposed budget in terms of what the 2014 budget will look like. I would say it's probably not going to look much different than the 2013, but if it doesn't get any worse, that will probably be a good thing. Mm-hmm. But the HUD, not just HUD, the Congress could take different actions in the 2014 budget to reverse some of the impacts of sequestration on us. That makes it different than other kind of sequestration cuts because we were already being funded 70 cents on the dollar for our Section 8 HAP admin fee. We were being funded at 83% for public housing and Section 8. So we were already so far below the 100%. So are you cutting the 5% off the 83, 84, or are you cutting it off 100? So there's those sort of questions that Washington has to answer in terms of how they do the budget. And when we get those answers, we'll have a clearer picture. I think that it's going to take us longer than I had hoped to get down to the right operating size because we want to honor our project-based Section 8 commitments. If we didn't have so many units coming online in the next year, it would have been an easier thing to do. But because we do, we want to make sure we plan accordingly and we'll probably overexpend, use some of our reserves that we've saved for this very purpose and this year, and then get back in business and started in the coming years once we get the Section 8 program to the right voucher size. Anything else I missed that we talked about this afternoon, Janet?
I think that's pretty much it.
I think Commissioner Nagaraj has a question.
Yeah, I really appreciate, I know that that there's still a lot of negotiations going on, so I really appreciate this kind of halftime report to help give us guidance, especially as we start the budgeting process. But I have some questions.
Sure.
So on the staff report, and Eric actually just mentioned some of these numbers. So for the paragraph that confused me a little bit, mm-hmm. It says on the second page, on the last full paragraph, in the FY 2013 budget, staff assumes 75% of funding eligibility with the additional 5% reduction. Program impact is $315K. For fiscal year 2014, 83% of funding eligibility. Can you just repeat where those numbers of 75% and 83% and 5% come from?
That's a really great question because it gets to the core of my frustration with the way in which we are forced to do business based on the way HUD does business. Because we're right now creating the 2014 federal fiscal year budget. We are guessing, and it is just a pull out of where do I think it's going to be that Congress is going to allocate the funding. Because every year they allocate the funding based on a percentage of the overall. So they have the pot of public housing, they have the pot of Section 8 HAP, they have the pot of Section 8 HAP admin fees, and they have the capital fund. And there's 100% eligibility is this amount that everyone agrees is 100%. So then what Congress does is they say, we're only going to give you 82 of this and 75 of this and 76 of this. So that level of insanity then trickles down in a way that we have to make our budgets into those kind of amounts. The housing authorities, and some of you know people in these housing authorities and commissioners with these housing authorities are struggling so much right now, did not project, honestly, their 2013 budget allocations. So instead of budgeting for an 83% half or a, 69% admin fee, they budgeted as though they were going to receive much more than that. And so they're in a really tight pickle right now. And those are the ones who are forcing to end vouchers on families, who are sending notices out because they had not planned, really, they guessed wrong, is I guess the best way to put it. So what Janet's doing with this and what she's saying here is that these are our current projections, and they could be wrong, they could be right, but they're currently our projections. You may see different numbers by the time you sit by April 30th. For one thing, I will have been back to D.C. for a week and maybe get a better idea of where this is going to land.
So I wanted to just to add to that briefly. The public housing operating subsidy, it is formula driven. So our staff have to go in and they calibrate based on number of units and a number of other factors. It's a very complicated equation. And really what you're doing is, as Eric said, it's a guess. You say, okay, how much of that do I think they're going to approve and fund us? And that's where that 75% number is. As we went through our calculation, we said, okay, this would be what we calculate based on the number of units we have and this formula that they have told us to use. And then we just took 75% of that and use that number as the basis for building our budget, which is ultra-conservative. Most people usually start at about 80, 81, 82%. So that is why we are not taking such a huge hit on it, is because we were very conservative. That's what that sentence means.
But the real way to do business would be if Congress passes a budget and says in 2014 you're going to have this amount of money for Section 8 HAP, go spend it. We don't know now until – we did not learn now until the second month – before our fiscal year ends, how much money they were going to give us this year.
That's incredible.
It is incredible. And it's an almost $200 million commitment that we're out there with.
And so then this extra nuance of different percentage allocations within. So it's not like they say you're going to get 89% of your budget for each of the different programs. It is literally
it's based on a formula.
Yeah.
And so that's it's per unit month times a certain number and then you submit it and then they have to approve it. So they know what that ultimate number is, you don't. So that's why I'm saying we have always historically been conservative when it comes to that operating subsidy, because you just don't know.
But this is one case where I think we really did a fairly heroic job at predicting and being cautious at a time when we knew. The board's talked about it many times the past couple of years. The writing was all over the wall. I honestly thought that they wouldn't go off the sequester cliff. I thought they would get an agreement. But I was wrong. Maybe both parties really wanted it because they both got something out of it. And now they start over trying to build up and fill the gaps. I don't know. Mm-hmm. But it's where we are, and it's a period that we'll get through. It may be, my challenge and I think the biggest problem I have with it overall is the long-term view that are we going to be serving fewer people because there's going to be less money, and the domino effect of doing that. When I say we may serve 800 to 900 fewer people a year, that's 800 to 900 fewer households times three. That's up 3,000 more homeless on the streets of Oakland, and I don't know that resonates with people well enough. But we will get ourselves back right-sized so that at least the people who are housed can be protected and not be cut off.
And I just had one more question. So this might be a drop in the bucket when you actually do the math, but for the future development projects that are coming up, if we assigned, so I don't know, I forget like what percentage of the units we're assigning vouchers for each of these projects, but is there any precedence for working with the developers to assign those vouchers to the higher AMI units, thereby reducing the amount, the operating expense the OHA operating expense, mm-hmm. so that you lift them from the 30%.
Yeah, I know what you're saying, doing income tiers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And there isn't, we have not done that, but that doesn't mean you can't do it. And it's something that we can consider doing. The other thing that we can consider doing to get to the same point is we have a large number of internal project-based Section 8 awards. We have roughly 1,500 award vouchers out there for OPI sites. And OPI sites, we could choose to hold back some of those and rent them at tax credit rents for 60% AMI or lower and use the vouchers for the tenant-based side. We could change that once we correct our voucher if we wanted to. But that's another way to mix up some income and lessen the HAP expense. Mm-hmm. Because you wouldn't have a HAP subsidizing that apartment. The tenant, the family would pay basically low-income housing tax credit rents. So there's a number of different solutions that we'll discuss with the ad hoc committee. And that's one is we could talk about tiering for some of them, but I think it almost maybe easier to do OPI in the short term, because we can change that back and forth based on what the board would like. We also have pre-funded, based on authority of the board, some post-retirement medical benefits. We're scheduled to make those payments. We can defer those payments for a year. So there's different areas within our obligated reserves that we could defer to get us over this over-leasing issue. But the real goal is to get us to the correct leased amount that we can sustain as quickly as possible. And that means not issuing new vouchers to tenant-based families, finishing up our obligation with the veterans, honoring our project-based Section 8, but that's it until we can get it to the right size. The attrition rate has continued to drop. We used to get over 50, and then it slowed to about 50, and now it's about 38 a month. So if you think we're only letting 30 go, it's a challenge to get down to 100% if you're at 109 or 107% of our eligibility. The other options we have that we are talking about and we'll be discussing more have to do with, for example, the sponsor-based program. We currently expanded that, writing them, freezing that contract at their current leased level because they haven't really, we'll see what the numbers are, I don't want to say, but we're going to wait and see on that one. I have a meeting with them on Wednesday and then saying, okay, we're stopping this now because this is all we can afford now. The other one is, portability. Mm-hmm. We've been discussing portability and what we can do about limiting portability. And we already quit accepting vouchers, so the 280 people who have moved to Oakland that we currently have on our books, we're getting checks from other housing authorities. But around MTW, we can do other work around portability that will help. In some ways, help stabilize Oakland, I think. But when we port, it really is a costly endeavor. It's costly for the housing authority. Not only are we sending HAP payments somewhere else, but it's a costly administrative endeavor. And the portability regulations under HUD are really onerous. Everyone has complained about them, but nobody has done anything about it. So we're looking at that in terms of our MTW flexibility, what we can do differently that would not only limit the cost of administering ports, but limit the ports and kind of control that. Mm-hmm. So we're going to look at that closely and then maybe bring that forward as an admin plan change and an MTW change later in the summer.
And that would be people porting out of Oakland,
yes.
Right?
Yes. Yeah.
I see.
Yeah, or porting in. We want to look at both because they're mm-hmm. both onerous. They're onerous on everyone involved, including our residents, who have to go through two housing authorities to get it done. And it just doesn't work, and it's a really challenging thing. I would say the number one requests for stuff that we get from various offices about complaints have to do with ports, either the receiving or sending, and where the documents are they cleared and clearing that up. It's an enormous bureaucratic nightmare that HUD created around mm-hmm. ports, and I think we could use maybe our MTW flexibility to try and clean some of that up and make it more useful for our residents. And it probably won't be as available to folks porting, but I think it would help control it mm-hmm. better. I mean, there are housing authorities in our region that have not opened their wait list for 13 years. Mm-hmm. They have not done so by absorbing other people's ports, because to open a wait list, to manage a wait list, is a costly endeavor. Mm-hmm. And they've never really had to do it. We mm-hmm. open our wait list, as you know, often. We port frequently, and we are the ones they're absorbing from. So we're really doing a lion's share of work around these families, and they're not really paying for it on the other side. But we'll look at that and bring that mm-hmm. back. Is there any other?
Well, we've got our standard operating. We're looking at capital expenditures.
Yeah,
we're
going to
postpone some of those things that are happening internally.
Yeah, I think Commissioner Hurd has a question.
Oh, no, I was done. You're fine.
Actually, I have four questions.
Okay.
And I'm hopeful. I've been sitting at the national level in these meetings and just hearing all of this. And then I see the families. I see homeless. I see the veterans. I see children. And I come back here and I say, what's going to happen? What can we do? And so in reading this, it helps me see the impact decisions make. And the impact that one decision makes to a whole nation. That's what I see now. Now, my questions were four. First question. I think the director talked about cash flow management.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, what's our goal with that?
So cash flow becomes very important because right now, and we mentioned in our memo here about the fact that the Housing Authority has to, for every expense above and beyond the housing assistant payment expense, we actually have to wait 3 months and request the money from HUD.
Okay.
So that equates to right now about $10 million, and we basically have to float that money until HUD releases it. So we don't have it in our coffers. It's just if we don't have the money, then that's our overhead costs. That's our family and community partnerships. So those extra expenses are not covered. So right now the process is I send them an email and they send me the money. They could turn off that spigot at any time.
Okay.
So what we have to do is plan for that and analyze our numbers to say how long should that spigot be turned off. Mm-hmm. What impact would that have, and how can we sustain?
Okay.
And the other side of that is also just in terms of our development activities. When are the checks actually going to be written to the commitments we made? Should we make our payment this year for the post-retirement medical benefits and some of those other choices within the obligated line?
Correct.
When you obligate money and you've done that to several projects, it sits there until it's used. And some of these projects we're going to be working with real estate development, seeing exactly how much money they need when.
Okay.
So we have the money available. If the money's not being used for that, we can use it for something else and replace it as we earn it.
Okay. And my second question, and cost-saving alternatives.
Mm-hmm.
And what stood out for me is the one that talks about consider changes to the voucher payment standard. And what can we do with that?
So some housing authorities have, as part of their efforts to prevent private landlords from actually receiving no payment, they have asked them to reduce their payment standards. So just for instance, if normally they're getting, $1,300 a month and that equates to 100% of the payment allowance, they might ask them to take, $1,200. And basically that allows them to continue to receive a payment without having to be basically cut off the program.
Okay.
It's a painful choice between serving more people, the same people, or with less subsidy, or serving fewer people.
Okay.
But that is the choice that most housing authorities are grappling with right now. Some housing authorities, and I believe that San Francisco has 115%, voucher payment standard. So they go up to 150% of the market so they can try and get vouchers in more desirable neighborhoods.
Okay.
We haven't done that here, but they have. They could pull that back to 100. A lot of housing authorities are saying, let's only go to 90. So they're going to lower the subsidy amount. They're going to try and use the same amount of money to serve the same amount of people, but they're going to serve each family less. The other choice is to serve fewer families.
Right. And cut landlords off the program.
Yeah. Okay. Third question. Hypothetically, let's say it happens, and we're talking about prioritizing.
Mm-hmm.
What would we prioritize?
So what the process that's going to be occurring is I am evaluating, along with my staff, and discussing internally with the leadership team what makes the most sense. And so there's analysis that needs to go behind each and every alternative here to give you all the information so that you can make an informed decision in terms of monetary impact, give you our best thinking on how we would utilize the attrition and other factors, and then come back to you with some level of prioritization. I will tell you right now, freezing the wait list is probably the first thing that, which we've talked about already. And then the second thing is basically dealing with the port issue. So we're trying to do things that have the least amount of impact to our families and our landlords first, and our staff. And then basically once those things are vetted, what is the savings or the result? How is it going to address the deficit? And then we go on to the next item and do that analysis and bring it back.
Okay. And my final question, it says here that HUD could choose to implement regulatory measures to provide relief to all housing authorities. How do we make that happen?
That's a good point. And I've included the letter of recommendations so everyone can read them and they hit the public. And this was reissued by SOL in CLOFA just last week. And there's a large push to do this. Okay. One of the things that Sandy Enriquez put in a recent memo about sequestration that she was recommending is full funding fungibility to all housing authorities. And I think that is definitely what they should do. They should say, this is the money and here's the pockets, but to be able to move it to preserve families is really what they should be doing. I was able to share that with her personally, how grateful I was. She finally put that in writing, and she laughed. She was stuck, like it wasn't possible. And I said, but it's out there now, and it's in writing, and the more noise that we get back up to the hill on it as a solution, that would really help a lot of housing authorities. In terms of regulatory relief, though, there are different views on regulatory relief, and one of them you brought up earlier in this meeting. One of the views on regulatory relief is to get through to eliminate Section 3 requirements.
Right.
So there's a double-edged sword to regulatory reliefs. One of the things we've learned in MTW is how much we can start saving if we do triannual recertifications, risk-based inspections, those sort of authorities, and those are the things that we're really talking about with HUD that they should implement. The reason that the letter was kind of important to include is it says what HUD can do without going to Congress.
Yeah.
These are things that are within HUD's regulatory ability. They're not statutory requirements.
Right.
So HUD is choosing to regulate it in this way, and they can make another choice.
Yes.
So the likelihood of those going forward are better. Because we're MTW, those don't necessarily impact us as much because we're already doing almost everything that we can think of. But I think for the rest of the housing authorities, including those families who are porting into us or to another jurisdiction, but certainly into us, it makes a difference. Because one of the things that is in almost all the admin plans that we'll be working at drafting is if you ever do have to cut families who are currently on the voucher program, how do you do it and in what order or priority? Is it the oldest family first? Is it the last family in out? Is it, how do you do that? A lot of housing authorities have already passed policies like that, and we'll be considering one this summer. But one of the first people they cut on the list are the ports.
Yes.
So we could very much, we have 280 families in Oakland that are currently subsidized through another housing authority that pay us. If those housing authorities implement their admin fee to downsize, that it will probably be the first families cut.
Okay.
And they will be at Michelle's desk wanting to see what she can do for them. And the question is, what can we do for them? Can we absorb them or not? And that's sort of an immediate risk for us in terms of porting, but also for the families. So, and our families who are ported to another jurisdiction. So we have 1,000 families in Alameda County. That's a lot of families. Those families are supported by us in terms of the HAP. In terms of the Section 8 admin fee, they only get a prorated HAP. To administer. So they don't get the admin fee to really administer the full program because we do some of the work. And that's why I think it's kind of a first stop. But those are some of the regulatory reliefs and same, changing the portabilities, changing the way that you structure rents, allowing you to do anything, go down to 90% area median rent levels to put less subsidy on a unit. The tenants will end up paying more. those authorities have two edges, I guess, is what my answer is.
Okay. That's all my questions. Thank you, Janet.
You're
and
welcome.
Director, thank you.
Commissioner Castillo.
Thank you. I appreciate the thought that we are engaged in right now because it's hard. Hard decisions all the way around. And I think that what I would like to talk about is just clarifying for me where how far we've gone in the thinking. Concerning freezing the waiting list, does that include all of our waiting lists, public housing and scattered sites and Section 8?
Currently, right now, we've just talked about the Housing Choice Voucher 2011 wait list. Combined from the both the 2011 and 2012, we pulled some 600 families approximately. Mm-hmm. So our thinking is for the scattered sites, we're going to continue to move forward because those are vacancies we need to make sure that we fill. And we will assess as we go forward how far we will go with that, because that's sort of a double-edged sword in that you have both the renovations that need to occur as well as you now are earning the subsidy. So you want to get the rents and renovate the units as well. So right now the thinking is just for the Housing Choice Voucher 2011 is like, okay, let's stop on that one. Because we still have these other, some families are still looking, and Director Johnson mentioned there's veterans that now have just received information or they're on their way in to come in for their eligibility intake. You don't want to stop those folks. You want to make sure that they can go ahead and see the process through.
Thank you very much. And also public housing, did you include in that conversation? It's a little different, right?
Yep, public
they
housing.
They have their own waiting list.
That's correct.
And that's going to continue.
That will continue.
Concerning issuing transfer vouchers to other jurisdictions, and I know we've talked at length about that, is there a clause in our thinking about for emergency vouchers, people who are suffering from domestic violence or some kind of safety issue that we do need to move a family, that's going to still be in place?
Correct? Absolutely.
Concerning the new development activity, are we also thinking of not or postponing our vouchers to other nonprofits, nonprofit developers?
Right.
Because we do have our hands in a couple
right.
of other stuff.
Right. So that is part of the consideration. I think that as we work with the Real Estate Development Department as to whether or not those projects are actually going to come online when they say they are, the other issue that will come before the board, because when we enter into our AHAP agreements, they are time limited. And so part of the reason why you do that is so that if something should happen, because everything is subject to the federal appropriation, then it's time for you to stop and say, okay, is this a project really going to go forward, or is it a project that's on hold, so we're just going to actually revisit our commitment to that project. So I do think that there's opportunities to take a look at some of those. We know that some of the project-based commitments, we actually had a list of those developments created for us today so that we could kind of get a sense of the timeline. And there are some on there that either are further delayed or they're not going to happen within the time frame. And that's the decision by the board to say either we want to extend the commitment or no, if they're not going to go forward, if their funding has fallen apart, then we are not going to commit to that anymore. We're not going to further that. So those are all decisions that would come back to the board after we've had some further internal discussions about how we should proceed.
Thank you very much. Mm-hmm. Lastly, because everyone here knows that that's the population that I work for is our homeless families and individuals, I can only imagine that the impact that we are going to have on the streets of this city. We're already at max. We already have families coming and calling on a daily basis, and the sequestration cuts haven't even hit yet. So very concerned that we get together as a community and maybe have some tables where we could actually address some of the things that's about to happen. I'm not sure. There could be some tables in our community that we could sit at as an Oakland Housing Authority to be part of the solutions.
I agree.
I really don't see us rebounding back as a nation very quickly, putting more money into affordable housing. It hasn't been the case since 1985.
Right.
So perhaps we need to get proactive and talk differently about solutions that does not require such a dependency, I'm going to say it HUD, or subsidies, and what does that look like to think out of the box? And anyway, that's something to think about. And I've heard our director and our staff come up with some really creative ideas on how to do that. And so I'm looking forward to working with you to bring us back online. Thank you so much.
Thank you for that comment. The one thing I wanted to also just point out, there was an article on Friday in the Mercury News from a lot of housing authorities, and we were in it. But one of the things they didn't include in my comments is it's not just us. It's Health and Human Services, it's mental health services, it's every other federally funded service in the city for families that are targeted. So although the housing is impacted, what about all the other services and resources, and how many other people are going to be impacted in different ways? And the impact on a given household, because so many of these are shared clients, is so profound because it's so compounded within a certain group of very low-income households in this city that are going to shelter this and shoulder this sequestration cut, that I think it's really appalling. But what we can do by talking together, maybe we can find other solutions with them. But it's more than just the housing. It's every federally funded service in the city.
I'd like to mention the Peers Housing Action Team meeting that I go to once a month, Director. And as I kind of wear a double hat there, I represent us and I also represent my organization I work for. And they actually have nonprofit developers and all kinds of folks come and sit at that table. And I'm going to bring this up there and see if we could just get some more momentum out of it.
Thank you. You know, it just strikes me, what's really been striking me is how important it is to keep focus on the actual human impact of what's going on. That, you know, it's not statistics. Mm-hmm. It's not like, well, we cut the budget and save some money. It's like, look at the consequences of actual human beings. I mean, this is really some serious stuff that is happening here. And I really, Commissioner Castillo, share your desire to be less dependent on the capriciousness of the federal government. I mean, there's no way really out of that, but we've been working for a long time looking at ways that we can at least kind of chip away at that somewhat. And, you know, hopefully we'll be able to continue doing that. I just had one other question. Eric, when we come in with budgets where we're budgeting, you know, at 86% instead of 100 and this sort of thing, is there any political or other downside to presenting budgets like that? I mean, is there any risk that they're like, hey, wow, you guys are figuring out how to do this for less, so guess what?
I think if people were watching as closely, they could try and say that. You know, you're caught between the rock and the hard place. One of the things that I think we need to be clear about is that we are going to serve fewer families with fewer dollars in this agency. So I've tried to put that out as much as I can, and anyone who interviews me usually gets a head count of how many families, because that's the real crux. You're going to give me less money, I'm going to have less money for these families, and there's no way around that. The percentiles they fund is a game HUD's played for years, trying to prove what is the minimum amount of money they can give the public housing program before it completely crumbles. And that's really been the game. One of the things that Secretary Donovan said in a meeting I was with a couple weeks ago with him is that he wanted to try and change the platform. So he wanted to move it. He realized that public housing, Section 9 of the Act, was so enormously unpopular among Congress that he wanted to find a way to move the platform over to Section 8. Because Section 8 was not enormously unpopular, was usually much, 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 much better funded over history. And I think that that's the direction HUD's going to go as quickly as they can. They have the RAD proposal to try and do that. But under all that is still trying to figure out how much are they don't want to give us more money than it takes to do the job. So they're always trying to balance that. And with the prorations of a, what did the HAP end up being? Do you remember on 2013?
Probably about 83, 82.
Yeah, for the HAP mm-hmm. payments, which is still historically low. But the admin portion was even cut further. It's mm-hmm. cut down to 70.
70%.
And you know what housing authorities are saying is we can't administer the program. So you give us money for the rent subsidy, I can't get a voucher in place because I don't have the staff or resources to do it at this point. So it does become dangerous, and I think until they see some numbers change and some lack of, honestly, some fairly challenging, not so cooperative responses from the housing authorities about requests for information and requests for this and requests for that and lease up and things that they push on a HUD level, until they hear us say, no, we won't get that to you today, you may get it by April. I may make them start filling out a form for request for submitted electronically at a website. Until they get it, and they don't right now, of the challenge of trying to help people. Because one of the things that you have to realize is that HUD's a bureaucratic system of paperwork, checks and balances, and boxes. And we try and translate that to people. And one of the things that I hope we do better is work with the people better in a way that the people are more empowered and that we're actually doing the good in the communities. And the challenge we have is we still have to talk to the people who only check boxes. And the whole MTW reporting and assessment tool and the fight that I've had over the past year and why I'm going back again for a week to go over it all over again is because the people who just check boxes, that's all they know how to do. And I want them to learn to assess housing authorities on a risk-based model and look at us as we, in an intelligent, holistic way, and assess us, probably much more rigorously than they ever have. But not just check boxes, so they will realize when they give us an 83% allocation that it's actually 800 households with, you know, 3,000 people with, you know, 1,900 kids. Anyway, did that answer it? I don't know, I went on.
Yeah. Thank you.
Okay.
any more questions, comments, or discussion? Commissioner.
This is concerning the letter under NARO. Sorry I didn't bring it up when I was had the floor a minute ago. Under fraud recovery, retain the higher of 50% of the amount collected. What is that about instead of a...
So if we go out and we find out someone's committed fraud against the Section 8 program and we collect, say, $10,000 from a family who's been fraudulent for a number of years, we have to turn a chunk of it over to HUD. And what we're asking HUD to do is to waive that and let us keep the fraud recovery to use for help other families.
Why
what happens when someone commits HUD?
When,
because HUD requires it. So if there's... And I can't remember what the percent is. Chief, do you know? Are you listening? The 50.
Are you listening?
Sorry. he's dealing with emergencies throughout Oakland. The 50% there. What they're asking for is we were subsidizing a family, which was, to our belief, until we caught them and proved them and got the collection, to be housing them and using money you gave us in good faith, and now we've recovered this, and you want 50% back.
Wow.
And what we're saying is let us use that money to go re-help somebody else.
It still doesn't make sense, but now I completely understand it.
Thank you.
And I might add, we do well with fraud recovery. We do well with fraud recovery. Our chief is very good at it, his team.
Okay, were there any more questions? Do you have a... Okay. All right. So I guess we can move on then to... Item C, consent agenda. And Commissioner Castillo, I believe that you wanted to pull one of these items for discussion.
Item C1, Chair. Oh, we got a vote.
Okay. So we will pull item C1 mm-hmm. for discussion.
Okay. Any other items?
And I think we are waiting for a motion now.
I'll move the other items for approval.
And the other items have been moved. Is there a second?
I'll second.
We have a second. All those in favor, please say aye.
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 All those opposed? Any abstentions? Carries unanimously.
Thank you, Commissioner.
Okay, so on to item C1.
On to item C1. Item C1 is a returning item. It was moved at my request from the last meeting. We're bringing it back with some additional information, but we also have some folks in the audience from Youth Uprising, including Ola Simmons, the executive director. I want to thank her for coming down tonight. I'll turn it over to Patricia Eisen, our deputy executive director.
Good evening, and thank you. As our executive director indicated, we have in our presence this evening the leadership team of Youth Uprising, the CEO, Ola Simmons, as well as her leadership team for YU Works, Nina Bergson, the director of social enterprise, Claudette All, the administrative manager, and Ali Knight, who is the chief of program. As indicated in the board memo that you're looking at this evening, our first year with YU Works as a job training program, in partnership with Youth Uprising, and I want to just emphasize that this isn't a regular vendor program, but rather a program where we took the opportunity to engage 47 opportunity youth, formerly known and commonly called at-risk youth in the city of Oakland, all Section 3 eligible, several of them our housing authority clients.
Thank you. I thought I heard myself. I apologize for that. 47 Section 3 youth who, at the cost of $4,018 for the entire program, not only received on-the-job training in terms of landscape and janitorial for on-site programming, but also supportive services. They were assisted with everything from life skills, financial management training, life skills management training. Several achieved their GED. Program, and several of them got employment unsubsidized following their completion of the YU Works program. All of these 47 young people were pulled out of situations where they might otherwise have taken alternate paths and got an opportunity to experience what it means to be self-sufficient and take responsibility for self and look forward to the future. Since the completion of that contract, YU Works has continued to provide the job training program for youth on site, 55 properties within our Deep East AMP 9 community. The Housing Authority staff that were originally assigned to that location are now working in AMP 10, so it gave us an opportunity to enrich on-site services to the AMP 10 community so that YU Works can concentrate on their portfolio of 55 sites. They met all requirements of the contract and in some respects exceeded it by the fact that we had 47 opportunity youth who presented themselves with taking advantage of the job training program. The contract has been managed over the last year by the Housing Authority team of Nanette Beecham Sparks as the acting assistant director for property management. Well, but as of Monday, is about to be taken over by the current director of property management. So I'd like to introduce to you Mark Schifferl, who's sitting next to me. And this is his transition to take the helms and lead us into great, bold, new things, cost effectively in filling units during the next fiscal year.
Great.
So I don't know if you want to say anything, Mark, about the opportunity to manage the contract and what you've seen so far with the property.
Thank you for your time, and excited to be here and be a part of the team at Oakland Housing Authority. Very excited to lead the department into the next phase and talking with Patricia and Eric about kind of what that opportunity brings and housing more families in the area. Had a special little round of site tours over the last week and was able to see some of the properties that Youth Uprising also is key on keeping up. So. Looking forward to working with them and continuing with this project over the next year.
And as I mentioned, the CEO, Ola Simmons, is here to join us and to answer any questions you might have about the program.
Ola, you want to join us tonight? Good evening.
Hi, everyone. I'm really, really excited to be here, and I want to just start by saying they're not on.
Okay, could you please list your name just for the record so that we...
Yes, Ola Simmons, O-L-I-S like it's Sam, S-I-M-M-O-N-S. I am the founding chief executive officer of Youth Uprising. So I'm really excited to be here, and there are really just three things I want to add to the very lovely presentation of this partnership that we have developed. One is that the cost effectiveness is important to understand because when we look at opportunity youth as they're defined in our nation, they're young people 16 to 24 that are not connected to school or work. They're young people who, they actually are only 17% of the overall population in that demographic, but they're really, really concentrated in several places in our country, and certainly Oakland is one of them, and East Oakland is another one. Those young people cost us, particularly the population that we work with at YU Work, cost our nation about $70,000 per young person. When they're out there, they're not employed, they're not in school, and they're not heading towards a pathway that is productive, where they're going to be working, they're going to be paying rents, they're going to be actually paying taxes. And so that we've been able to actually enter into this partnership, it's one of the ways that I think the Oakland Housing Authority is a national sort of trendsetter, that we're thinking about how do you go in and do a job training program for the people who are having the most negative impact on our community and make them solutions, make them assets. So I really want to thank you for the opportunity to partner. We're only 1 year in, and so we're working out the kinks. Like anything that you do that is bold and innovative, you learn as you go. We didn't come in. There's not a template for this. There are not other places in the country that really are doing this that we've been able to find. So it's really, really cost effective. But mostly, it's just amazing. It's amazing that we have gone together on this journey to think about how do we do something different with the resources we have. Many people are afraid to be in that neighborhood. These are young people who live there. They're not afraid to be there. They feel like this is their community. They get to do something positive in it. So we're really excited, and so we're happy to answer any questions. I'm not necessarily the data queen on the details, so I have my staff to back me up. But certainly the big picture, anything that you want to know, we're happy to answer.
As you mentioned, one of the learning phases that we encountered this year was understanding that these young people also need mentoring, so we have embarked upon a shared orientation program. Our landscaping team, Keith McCree, will actually be giving them a half a day on just how to take care of the water-efficient plants that we've put down on the ground and kind of do some of the things about what it means to plan how you take care of a site. So we're offering with them an opportunity for our staff to actually get a chance to mentor and get engaged with the young people too. And that actually is in 2 weeks' time at properties that they take care of now.
And I just want to personally thank Youth Uprising for when I fielded the idea about doing something differently. And it's this, it's summer youth employment. It's trying to find a different solution and a different way with working with our partners. And the board has been so supportive in encouraging me to do that since I've been here over 5 years ago. It's been their mission to do things differently. And they are one group that has really risen to the occasion in a neighborhood that I think we would all admit needs love and attention, and one that I think that Oakland Housing Authority has a strong presence in and can help be one of the people who give love and attention. And I want to thank them, and I want to thank Alice for her incredible leadership in Youth Uprising since I've known of the organization. Has been just one of the pillars that I've seen in terms of model examples in this country of how you can impact a community in a focused, intelligent, and sustainable way.
I've heard your name a lot, and it's really good to see your face now. Know who you are now.
Thank you.
Okay, a couple questions. Regarding employment, you know, when they come out, what types of jobs do we get them?
You know, it's really interesting because what we found in this program is that young people learn some things that most of us here learned at home. We learned really young. And so what we're really transmitting are some soft skills that are really transferable. How do you show up? How do you work with the team? How do you conduct yourself appropriately? Some young people come in and say, I really hate that person is telling me what to do all the time. And we have to be like, so that's your supervisor. That's their job. And so we don't track young people into a particular job. It really is about making them job ready. And so some people have gone into food service. Other young people have gone to UPS. We've got some young people that at the zoo. I think the young person that I'm most proud of, there's a young man, Curtis, who started with us in this program. And Curtis is now in an EMT program that is a post-secondary program that actually is training him to actually work for, because it's a great job to work for either Paramedics Plus or to work for one of the other companies. And so I tried to get him to come with me this evening, but apparently he has a social life. Okay. So it isn't a tracking program necessarily into a groundskeeping and landscaping. It's a tracking system for them into the rest of their lives.
Yeah. And my last question is, that was going to be my question. I think, and I have this thing about stories.
Yeah.
And I think when when we, the housing authorities, intervene in a youth's life. That is so beautiful.
Yep.
Hearing their story of what happened to them when it happened would be even good, too.
Yeah. I mean, we actually are trying to, because we're new in this relationship, figure out the best way to interface with the board. We have a number of young people that we would love to do case studies on, or maybe even produce a really short video. We've got some video production capacities to bring the lives of those young people, because for me to tell you is not nearly as profound as when they talk about, I actually was on my way someplace else that wasn't good for me or my family, and this gave me hope and possibility about the future. And so we defer to the board and to the director about the best way to do that. But we have talked with Patricia very preliminarily about maybe doing a video so that we can bring multiple young people to you.
Wonderful. Thank you, Alice. Appreciate that. Thank you.
Hi, yes, I've heard so much about Youth Uprising, and it's wonderful to meet you. I just have a couple of questions. How is this training? Are these young people, are they referred to you? How are they referred to you?
So I'm going to defer to my staff about how we get them. I think that what we do is we have an eligibility criteria. You have to be very low income. Ideally, you're living in either a Section 8 with a Section 8 voucher or in one of the properties. And the young people come to us, I would imagine, like many of our programs, mostly word of mouth. Is that true?
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah, mostly through, you know, the other programs within Youth Uprising, but we've also, you know, just being out there, being a crew that's out, when they stop for lunch and they see young people, and they've learned to be their own advocates and their own, you know, kind of outreach mechanisms. And they come back with stories. Oh, we met this young. I hope he comes. You know, oh, he came back, you know, on Thursday. So it's throughout the community and then within Youth Uprising.
So and like youth outreach, too.
We absolutely outreach. We absolutely do. The other thing
I wanted to intercede. Our Family Community Partnerships also does referrals both for our partnership with Youth Uprising for our Mayor's Summer Job Program as well as YU Work. So when they talk about word on the street, sometimes the word on the street came from the street, Union Street, and Family Community Partnerships. Yeah.
Okay, my other question to you is that this is year-round. This is not just summer.
That's right. We have a program that we run with you that is just in the summer. It bleeds over a little bit into, wrong word, but it leans over a little bit into the fall because we want to make sure that young people are actively enrolled back in school. But this program, the YU Works program in front of you, is a year-round program.
Okay.
And it really is, I want to be clear, a job training program that creates a supported work environment for young people who are not independent of this experience, job ready. They're not going to go out into the labor market and compete and get a job on their own. It's the place that we find them when we bring them in.
And is there a term, a length of time, like say 6 weeks, 8 weeks, 10 weeks?
So because what we're asking young people to do is do a job that is a professional job. We don't have a short term. It's not like you come in 6 weeks. And so it's a really good question about how we think about it and we structure it. So for instance, there's the EMT program. It has a very specific curricula. You go in and you get through that program, and at the end of it, you get a certificate, you take the state test, and you go on. This is for young people that are often a step before that. And so how long they stay in the program really has much more to do with where they are when they come to us, more than there's a standard curricula, and then there's a graduation point. Young people who show up on time, work well with others, have a good relationship with their supervisors, then we know that they're ready, and we start promoting them. We link them up with a job counselor, they get their resume, and we start helping them interview. So it's about their own pathway more than a structured program for us.
And with that structure, one of the things that's awesome is that in terms of professionalism, the youth are trained on not just how to come to work, so they're uniformed in the YU Works identifying gear, but also how to care for their tools and the supplies that they need. So it really is about helping them learn the things that, unfortunately, they didn't get before joining the program.
I also don't want to underestimate the power of having folks from the community getting jobs in the community and cleaning up and working in the community. You know, Sean Donovan, Secretary HUD, was talking about doing these, and it's a nice phrase, ladders of opportunity.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
I love the ladders of opportunities. I want elevators and escalators as well. This is a ladder, Maybe one day it'll be an escalator.
That's right.
And maybe one day it'll be an elevator. Yes. But right now it's a ladder of opportunity for those who are willing, who are going somewhere else, mm-hmm. seeing the crew, saying, well, how come that guy's working?
Right, yeah.
And that's how it really happens. And that's how you help the neighborhood try and attract some of the people who could have had a different life. And they've chosen this road now and having that opportunity. And I think one of the things that we need to think about in almost everything we do is how can we provide the opportunity in the neighborhoods for the families that we serve. And this is one opportunity.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you. The parents.
Yes. Yes. You know, I have to give you the answer I always give, so forgive me. So often when people come to us and they ask us about parents, I say to them, I bet you mean grandparents, because so many of our young people themselves are parents. And so yes. what we find is that we're dealing with three generations. We're dealing with really young children. We're dealing with the young people that are in the YU Works program, and we're dealing with their parents because they're often still sort of living at home. And so we don't provide by design direct services for the grandparent, but we do provide a network of support for the entire family. And so we find that when you're working with the young person on the crew, you have to work with everyone in that household because they're impacted by everybody in that household. So it's a multi-generational opportunity.
I am so glad to hear that. Thank you. Thank you.
You know, I am very curious as to what the what the success rate is in keeping people out of bad stuff yeah. and bringing them into good stuff yeah. because, I mean, the challenges facing these kids are quite non-trivial.
Yeah.
And among those challenges, at least I am told, that one of the most challenging ones is the fact that as soon as a kid tries to really become constructive, they're now going against their group. They're going against the group they've been with. So they're really being pulled back by this group in various ways. And this is a real hard thing, I would think, to break away from. And so, I mean there's got to be some real skill involved in making that happen.
So I'm smiling because it's really about building a new social structure and a new construct about
yes.
what is acceptable and right. And so when you have a crew, when you have a group of people who
yes.
show up every day, they're together, they're showing up, they're uniforming together, they're
uh-huh.
working together, they're lunching
I
together,
get it.
You begin to create a new norm. And so
mm-hmm.
what we have found is the importance of having the adult role model with them all the time. And so the opportunity to partner with the Oakland Housing Authority and have their staff also come in and be those role models and those mentors, give the young people yet another set of folks to look at to say, maybe I could have a different life, maybe I could have some different options. But it's true, we have found that the one at a time, without a cohort model, the social pressure
mm-hmm.
to sort of keep doing what you've yeah. been doing is overwhelming.
There's a awesome table on page 3 of the white paper that Youth Uprising provided for us, Return on Investment, OHA Job Training Program for Opportunity to Youth. Actually goes hand in hand with the conversation we've been having for the last few agenda items, and that is the correlation between crime stats and job opportunity stats and the ability to continue to redirect opportunity youth to jobs that are available. And of course, with things like sequester and subsidized programs going down, that will continue to be a challenge. So every opportunity for a partnership like this one, we're at least reaching some core of kids. And 47 at $4,000 a pop is a huge, huge return on investment.
And once we can get those that kind of impact, once we have a little
mm-hmm.
more history, because they've only
That's
been
right.
doing this for a year, like
That's
Austin
right.
said, we can look at where this could go in terms of its current programming, current funding levels, but also other opportunities that might exist
mm-hmm.
to try and expand into other areas. But first we need to get this in place, but I'm just throwing that out there that there may be a point where we come back actually to change this up in some ways
mm-hmm.
and add more funding in the interim. All
right. Right, and I am fully aware that we're not going to have, you know, some kind of quantitative figure, but the answer to my question was quite good because when I hear you talking about setting a new norm, that just makes sense to me. Then I start thinking about this is where it gets depressing, because I start thinking about the enormity of the problem. I mean, we have 40% of the kids in high school aren't going to make it in Oakland. And I have had some people inside the school district tell me that that number is really not right. It's actually more like 50. And then I was talking to a little while back, I was talking to a professor from UC Berkeley who said, you know something? He said, these kids that are dropping out of high school, he said, we are literally creating an unemployable class.
That's true.
And he said, this is really scary. That's and true. So you start thinking about that. So I always, when I see these good things happening, I'm always looking for how can they be expanded and or how can they be replicated? You know, what can happen to start to diminish the sense of hopelessness of solving the problem? You know, because I really think with people like us, the people we have in this room, one of the strengths that we have is that we're all very hopeful people. And most of us, I mean, a lot of us anyways, are pretty competent as well. it gives me some optimism that there's things that we can do working together. But we have to expand this in some way or another to get more people, more organizations. I'm not sure what needs to happen, but I think that these are the kinds of discussions that we have if we're going to solve the problems of Oakland, because the problems of Oakland are our problems, you know, so we shouldn't ignore the larger picture as well. So thank you very much. I think Commissioner Nagaraj had a question.
Yeah, I just wanted to appreciate Ms. Eisen. I told you before, but just looking at the staff report, it was very thorough, it was very detailed. It provided a lot of information that the last staff report didn't. I like that I think the last one was a 2-year contract. This is a 2-year with a renewal option. I think it helps us manage our programs, our cash flow. We're building up our internal FCP department as well, where we're also, you know, trying to specify and quantify as much as you can, which is the hardest thing to do in social service world, success and what that looks like. So I really appreciate reading this time.
Absolutely, thank you. Thank you. I also am very impressed, and thank you so much for coming to this board and explaining the program to us. One of the things that I thought, which is I think what Deputy Director Eisen just clarified, is that it was isolated to a part of Oakland, not allowing our other children to sort of participate, not because they're not allowed to participate, but because transportation back and forth from maybe West Oakland or North Oakland or finding time to participate in the program would have been difficult for them. But when you say 55 sites, is that what you say?
That's all in that's 55 properties in our Deep East. AMP 9 is where they're assigned for the job training program. So the job training program is specific to our Deep East AMP 9. Does not mean, though, that Alice does not welcome children from across the city. And I believe you have support systems if transportation and that kind of thing is an issue that's part of the program.
See, that's one of the things that I was kind of concerned about, that we are a citywide housing authority, and this is such a great program. And so I wanted to look at ways where the recruitment can also extend out and make it accessible to more of the children, not out of AMP 9. I don't know where that is exactly.
It's everything from 72nd Avenue East toward the San Leandro border. You have 55 sites that we serve clients.
We call it Deep East.
We call it the Deep East, yeah.
Oh, Deep East.
Deep East. I'm sorry, was I saying it fast? Yes, ma'am. Deep East.
Okay, now I understand.
It's at Philadelphia.
Do you see yes. where I'm going with that? Because we have some children in West Oakland and North Oakland and I know BART, you know, but do you, out of the $4,000, and this is another place where I'm going, $4,000 for the length, let's just say 1 year, right? Is that what we're talking about?
Different young people are in the program for different periods of time, but...
And how many hours a week do they work?
They're working a 20-hour week. We have had situations where we've had them work a little bit more than that, but it's a part-time, it's considered a part-time job training program.
And the 4K accommodates the services that they're getting?
Right.
So we're paying for counselors and the staff in that 4K?
Well, let me say that it's a partnership.
So you're putting in some funding.
Yeah. So, but not in a way that shows up to like on a traditional budget. So we run this as a job training program. But in order to really meet the needs of young people, we know that they need case management, they need mental health, they need a whole host of things. And because that's the base of services that we already provide, those services are available. And I should acknowledge that two things. One is that getting it right and getting to high competency and mastery before we scale out, I think is really important, and I think that we're getting really close to that. But for the summer job program, we focus in the two areas that matter most in the city, which is East Oakland and West Oakland. So we're very comfortable in both of those neighborhoods. We have found a level of mobility between those two communities to be stunning. People think that if you live in West, you don't like East and vice versa. But we find that young people actually are very mobile back and forth between the two communities. Good. So we're very comfortable working in both, and I would agree that we want to do this and make it available to everybody. And to Director Johnson's point, like, it's about when do we come back and when are we ready to come back to really scale up.
So out of the 4K, part of that is salary for the children?
Absolutely, yes. The bulk of it.
What's the bulk of it?
The vast majority.
70%, 80%?
No, I would probably say 85% or so of it is salary.
Okay. And the children are getting clothing allowances and transportation costs?
We provide for them uniforms.
Their
uniforms. So that doesn't come out of that. We actually provide that.
Okay. What are some of the challenges that you had last year that you're going to address this year? Not all of them, because I know there's probably a bunch.
Yes.
And then I have
another question. You need prayer.
And I have another question, what might be included in your challenges, is turnover within the year that a child is going. Because I know that some babies probably only hang out for a month or three months or shorter than that. How do you do you have like 47 slots?
No.
And you
right. So the answer to the slots will answer the question to the turnover, right? I think that we have 25 slots. And so the 25 slots represents 47 young people for a host of reasons. Some young people were ready to move on, and we supported them in getting a job. Okay. Some young people actually felt like the structure was more than they could bear. Uh-huh. And so that they're not ready for that. But we're not letting them go. We're actually supporting them in other ways to get them ready. So that sometimes there's an on-ramp, there's a pre-job training kind of support that young people need. But I think the challenges are just the challenges you'd find in a new program. So how do we communicate all of what
communication
needs to be done
within the partnership? Quite honestly, the standards that the Housing Authority has for the properties and helping the youth understand those standards and meet them while they're learning at the same time. I think that the other thing I would say is that the energy level of the young people and helping them know that in a job it's going to be the same activities every day and keeping them focused. We have that issue sometimes here. So it's did I say that out loud? I'm sorry. So it mostly just about shoring it out so when the young people leave, they're confident, they have the skill set and the competency, and they have the courage to take that new path. And $4,000 is just the beginning for, as Alice has mentioned, parents who are just wanting to be good mamas and good daddies. So.
So the turnover is really a combination of things. Again, some of it is readiness to move on and we've placed them. Some of it is really about the structure's too much. We've had a couple young people that have moved out of the area during the course of the project.
Yeah.
So like any program, you have a host of reasons that you don't have 25 for the full year. And we never anticipated 25 for the full year. And as far as we're concerned, we don't want rapid turnover because we want the young people to be in the program long enough that it is a transformational experience. Mm-hmm. But we also don't want them in the program so long that 25 is the only number that we can serve.
Mm-hmm. I see. So we keep 25 in the program, and as people move out, more come in. And last year we served 47
in total
with those 25
slots.
Did you want to say something else?
I think all has really covered everything. I think I was just going to say that as the program gets a little older, it also becomes very attractive within our community.
Correct.
And so that becomes a little bit more of a motivating factor to stick it through on the harder days because they're a part of something and they worked to, you know, we also increase the structures around becoming a part of this. And, you know, just as you grow, you create structures, operational structures around
maintaining your job, maintaining the training, you know, et cetera. And so that attractiveness has been a compelling force in decreasing a lot of the turnover.
Thank you.
Oh, excuse me, just for the record, could you introduce yourself so we have you on the recording here?
Yes, sorry.
Yes, thank you.
Nina Berkson, the Director of Social Enterprise.
Thank you.
The dedication you see by the entire Youth Uprising staff here this evening is what we've had throughout the whole year. And I should add that when you go to meetings at the Youth Uprising Center, you also get lunch and great home squeeze lemonade made by the youth. So the dedication goes throughout the partnership there.
Alice, so what is the other staff here tonight?
Yes, so thank you so much for the opportunity to introduce them. So Ali Knight is the chief of programs with Youth Uprising, and so all of the personal transformation work that we do with young people is under his direction and guidance, and although technically he works for me, it really is the other way around, quiet as that's kept. And then we have Claudette Allen, who is a part of the, a large family in Oakland that is really well known for their community service. People may know that last weekend there was a huge Easter egg hunt for thousands of children at Mosswood Park, and her family has been running that for years. And so we're thrilled to have her, and she is the administrative reality for the social enterprises.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So I just have one more thing.
Go ahead.
This is my dream vision. I know that right now we're doing labor and gardening and even more different things. Maybe painting or something like that? No?
No, just gardening. Just grounds work.
I love that.
Yes, ma'am.
The jobs that we need to prepare our children for, and I know this is a dream, and I know that you guys are the engineers and the medical professions and the programmers, because our children are worth it, and all they need is access and opportunity. That's what our babies are missing. When I was, and I still am, a mother with four children, if someone said, well, send your child to college to be a programmer engineer, do you think I would say no? You know, but I did not have the opportunity to send my children. Oh, Lord. But that's the kind of vision that we need, that when we say expand the program, is it possible for us to go there so that we can have doctors and, you know what I'm saying, Facebook executive directors, and because that's what our babies, that's what they deserve, you know? So that's my dream vision, and I really love it that you guys came and talked to us, and thank you so much. Did you bring one of the kids?
All of the children had dates this evening. So, I mean, really, I asked three different. I was like, really?
Okay, thank you so much. And thank you, Chair.
Can you move it with that?
Let's move this item.
I'll second.
All those in favor? Aye.
Aye.
All those opposed? Abstentions? Carries unanimously. And Commissioner Castillo, thank you for pulling that item, because I had no idea the quality of education we were about to receive. Very nice. And so now, moving on to item D, people wishing to address the commission.
I believe
we have no speaker cards. And hearing no voices, we will move on to written communications.
Written communications. I've included the February 2013 written board packet. We will catch up, but our meetings are off, so we're a month off. So I will move on to the other written communications and go through those. Number one, Youth Employment Partnership. You'd asked for a report on the homes. Both homes are completed. They're currently being prepared for sale, and I will get you an update at the next meeting of the amount, but it looks like they're going to, the Oakland Land Trust is going to sell them, and the price will be around $125,000 is what I last heard, but I will get you something in writing about that and the progress and offering for sale. I've already put them in contact with our home ownership list, and I think that the mailers have already gone out to the people who are in FSS and have some escrow accounts established to possibly buy them. But they finished both of them. They're looking for additional properties. And just on a side note, we have a six-unit State 6. This is a State 6. The state gave us some properties many, many years ago when they were building a freeway. They had purchased some properties, and they had to keep them affordable. And they gave them to, I think in 1972, gave them to the Oakland Housing Authority. They consisted of these two homes and 10 other homes. and then another State 6, which is a sixplex, and it's around the mid-80s. I think it's on 86th Avenue. It needs some minor restoration, and we could probably lease it at sort of a affordable rate for some percentage, not even a half rate, but something just sort of a market rate affordable kind of apartment. So I'm thinking of talking to YEP about the next youth bill grant, because they're looking for property to go in and do the rehab, whatever they can do over the course of, you know, 12 or 18 months, and then they give it to us, we'd finish it up and lease it. I think it's a good way to put the property back online. Right now it's been sitting waiting for some determination. Given our forecast, I think maybe renting it at some very affordable rent would be more income for us, and since the property has no debt, it would be easy to do, and I think we could make it work. So it goes to your other question about how can we get outside the HUD. The other memo I prepared was leasing activities. There was just a lot of activities in March, so I wanted to update you. They weren't in the March, the February report. We had a open day, leasing day on Saturday at the first of the month, that's generated a number, a couple hundred people out looking for units within OP and public housing, and then we have all of the veterans coming in as well that are on the 2011 list. So we have a huge number of people out looking for apartments now in light of sequestration. I guess do the contrary. But I'm very happy with the results of the call in the leasing day. I think it's resulted in a number of things. One of the things I wanted to show you is we have on our preferences for our wait list that if you're local, if you're from Oakland, Live Work Oakland preference, you go to the top after veterans, senior disabled veterans, Live Work Oakland. So consequently, whenever you open a wait list, you get mostly you serve people from Oakland. The older the wait list is, the farther you go down, the fewer people you serve from the city. And I kind of just wanted to show you that. We're serving, you know, 73% of the people that have come in were from Oakland, and I think that's just terrific, because it was exactly the reverse a year ago when we were trying to call people in. So the leasing tables are just trying to put it all together for you, and it's an interesting thing, because you have to look at a couple reports to get it, but you have the number of units that are ready or available, you have the number on your wait list, and you have the number being referred to leasing, and that gets you to where you are in the current and available. This is kind of a dashboard for property management in terms of leasing up units. So you want to say we have currently 174 in OP that we're trying to lease up. We have a wait list of 5,520 now, so that's all up and running. They've referred, and this was, these don't include the March lease up day numbers. Referred for leasing 23, and then you look at the number who's accepted. They accepted 27, so now we're down to 147 units, and they had 38 move-ins during the month as well. So we're getting down to a zero, which I think probably by May's meeting you'll see last month's impact, and it'll be way down there. But I wanted to give something sort of simple for you to walk through. On the public housing side, we do a lot better. We have a couple of wait lists opening that I wanted to announce. So if you know people who are looking for housing, the links are on our website. They're Harrison and Adele are open. Palo Vista is open and closed, so that one isn't it. It's Mandela, Chestnut, and Linden are going to open later this month as well. So if you know people, particularly know seniors and folks looking, refer them to OHAHA.org, and the links are on there and the information's on there. I just want to include the letter that we did get, the $250,000 security grant. I announced it last time, but I wanted it to be in the packet, so it's part of the public document. And then I also wanted to let you know that we had the audit in 2012 where they were here for about 6 or 7 months and looked at everything, and this just the closeout letter, so it's also included in the public record. League of Women Voters lunch. If you would like to attend, please let myself and Greer know so we can hold a table. We're getting, I think, a table, Greer, for the league?
Half table.
So let us know. We'll get extra tickets if we need it, but I don't think we will based on our attendance. So please, if you haven't already confirmed, please let her know. For the commission meetings, I'm just so you know, April 22nd will be canceled. I will be in D.C. that month. Not in San Diego. I know some of you will also be in San Diego, but I'll be in D.C., unfortunately. The special meeting will be held on May 20th because of Memorial Day, so we'll cancel the 27th, and then we get back on a regular schedule. And that's all the written materials. So we're moving on to any questions.
A question about that. I guess a comment. It's, for me, it's really interesting. Oh, sorry. I have a question.
No, you go right ahead.
So this the page on where the applicants are from is really interesting to me. And I know that when I spoke to Janet, when the waiting list was open last time, and you know, the stats that you showed us of, I think it was a higher demand of studios and ones versus two, like the larger mm-hmm. bedroom units. And we were trying to postulate as to why that was. And then that got into conversation of where the applicants are coming from, and they don't mm-hmm. necessarily need to be in, you know, from the city, which is an important thing that a lot of people aren't really clear on. And mm-hmm. I forget the theories that were being bantied about, but, you know, why is there a lower demand of the larger bedroom? Is it concerns about schools, safety, just kind of changing demographics in the state or in the area? So anyway, so that led to a conversation and questions about kind of where our applicants are. So for me, it's really interesting, really helpful to see this table. Mm-hmm.
I thought it was informative. That one thing that we are doing, though, I would mention in light of that conversation, is we're looking at the OPE units and this project-based Section 8 units that we're rehabbing, and a lot of them have bedrooms that are extremely small. And our occupancy standards has two teenagers could have to live in that. And you couldn't get two beds in it without it being a bunk bed. So we've really looked at how those are configured. And one of the things we're doing is taking whenever possible and reconfiguring if there's a three-bedroom or a four-bedroom and taking one of the bedrooms and putting in bifold doors, opening it up to the living room so that there's another room to study separate from the TV, which I think is important for our education initiatives, but also lessening the density within that square footage of the number of people that are required to live there based on the program. So that's currently going on now. I've looked at almost all the different, I've gone through all the AMPs with OPE and looked at their different properties because we were doing different assessments. And one of the things that became really clear is a lot of our units would lend itself to that. Now, if in 20 years suddenly everybody needs the extra room, we can always close up the bifold door. So it's not a permanent change, but it's a change that we can serve our current needs of our current households. And what I really like best about it is it means that the family could choose to use that extra space how they see. So they could choose to use it as a bedroom, or they could choose to use it as a, you know, someplace separate where they can set up desks and they don't have to study when the TV's on in the same living room that's very, very small anyway. I think that part of the outcomes, part of the reason why education is a challenge for some of our households is just the real physical environments of our units. If you have a three-bedroom apartment and you have five people living there, four of them kids, you have a tiny bedrooms and a very small living room, and you're expecting them to do their homework while people are talking in the kitchen and doing TV, and, you know, it's really hard on a family that size to be in that kind of square footage. So trying to change some of the density, I think, is going to have some good impacts on some of the families that we're housing in the future. So those changes are going on related to meeting the needs and the size of our wait list. Yeah. The people you're seeing that are on this wait list are almost exclusively three bedrooms. Oh, back to me. Any other questions?
No, I think you're finished, right?
I just have a couple of comments for the director comments, and then we're on to other ones. Announcements, really. One is Mark Schifferl, who you met. We just wanted to welcome him as our new director of property management. I will be in D.C. the 22nd to the 26th. The first, I'm going to be meeting with all the deputy secretaries, then Sandy Enriquez, and then I have to stay over for a Housing and Development Law Institute, where it's going to be an Oakland fest. Jennifer's doing one session. I'm doing another one on MTW, and Patricia and Chief are doing another one on reentry programs. So we're going to put on a show in D.C., it sounds like. And then I announced the waitlist openings. Oh, and the Oak Groves are open. That's the other one, downtown. They're all senior. All these are senior.
55 or 62?
They're 62 or older. Yeah. Yes, Flo, 62. The fiscal year 2014 budget ad hoc committees, I mentioned we scheduled them for April 30th and May 2nd, 7th, both Tuesday. And would you rather do that at 6 or at 6:30? And it would be my other question, who's the chair? Those were my outstanding questions on that committee.
Doing
the budget committee
at 6 or 6:30.
Yeah.
Is that meeting?
Whatever.
The budget committee, I thought, was.
Well, you're the chair, Audie. So what do you?
Was Audie? No, you're in the audit. I think you're the audit.
Yeah, so am I. And that's why I'm deferring to you.
No, that's why I'm asking. Because if it's easier to do a 6:30, okay. Okay, and Audie's chair. Great. The Education Committee, I think we have our next meeting scheduled for May 15th at 6:30. And the 2012 audit and HUD FDS financial data systems entry was completed by the March 31st deadline. Janet hit the button on Sunday. She has all of my support and congratulations for getting that, moving the mountain to get that done on time. We need to do it by December 31st, and one day we'll get there. But we did it on time, and I'm grateful. Lastly, I just wanted to have an announcement from Commissioner Main called and to let you know that if you want to go to Soul Circus Wednesday, Thursday, or Friday at 10:30 in the morning performance, to please give him a call. He has tickets available from Larry Reed's office. All right? That's this Thursday, Friday. Yeah, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, the 10th, 11th, or 12th at 10:30. Give him a call. And I have a cell phone if you don't have it. And that's all my report.
Well, thank you. That was a highly efficient presentation. Okay, so moving on now to reports of commission committees. Were there any commission committees in the last month?
The Education Committee. We are rocking. We're rocking. I really want to thank Lenita. You good girl. You are really good. One thing I so appreciate about all the staff, how well we blend together and sharing our ideas and just listen to us. So I appreciate that. One thing I do want to report, the opt-in form that we're working on, at some point once we get that approved, we're going to be able to go inside our housing authorities' homes and help our parents with their children. And that's something that's going to be so innovative. I don't know of any other housing authority doing that in the nation. Do you? I don't think I do. And that's something that we're going to be a trendsetter to set, right? Okay. Thank you. That's the end of my report. Thanks.
Oh, wonderful. Excellent. Okay, next, are there any announcements by commissioners?
Well, thank you. I just want to, recognize and mourn the moving on of our superintendent. And Eric sent an email about this, but I just think that Dr. Smith has done such incredible work in the city and made such a huge impact in the Bay for the years he's been here, and then certainly in Oakland for the fewer years he's been here. I and a lot of people are just really emotional when we heard that he was going to be moving on. I feel like there's so much work that the Education Committee could not do but for him. There are vast improvements in OUSD. OUSD over the last 6 years has the greatest improvement of any urban school district in the state. The African American Male Achievement Department, the ongoing the ability to diffuse the charter versus public vitriol that's gripped a lot of the nation. Through his humility and kind of very easy way of communicating and his hyper awareness of racial dynamics made him so incredibly effective. So he'll be hard to replace. So I do want to recognize him.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you. Because of the situation that we are under, and it seems like we're in consensus that some way or the other there will be more people on the streets of our cities, California is attempting to pass by Assemblyperson Tom Amiano has authored a bill called AB5, which is the first homeless bill of rights in California. Maine got it first, so we'll be second in the nation if we get this passed. And if you think if there will be more people who are suffering from being unhoused on our streets, at least let's make it kinder to live there. There are laws in this city that criminalize our street children and our homeless, and they are being traumatized by on top of the situation that they're living under. So the bill speaks to a lot of things that could make their lives a little easier. Housing would be what they would like, and jobs and really basic human needs that should be should all of us should have. But AB 5 does some really good things, and I'm encouraging all of us just to take a look at it and to see if you can support it by sending a letter to your assembly person. It goes to the Judiciary Committee on April 23rd, and we're going to have a large contingent from many cities across the U.S. to support its passing. And just a letter is really what we're asking for right now. You can go to raphome.org to find out more about this, and we would love your support. Thank you.
Okay, then it is time for adjournment to closed session. We have a motion to adjourn.
I'll move to adjourn.
All right, very good.
I'll second it.
Then we are hereby adjourned. We'll take 10 minutes to refresh.